Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. With this lecture, we turn our attention to the second puzzle I laid out in the beginning, asking the question, why isn't there less conflict? I'm not going to provide any answers just yet, though. As with cooperation, I'm first going to take the time to convince you that we really do have a puzzle. On the first slide, as always, I lay out the goals for this lecture. First, I'm going to introduce some new terms and concepts. Well, actually, none of them are going to be new, but the way I'll use them, while common in the field of international relations, may differ from what you're used to. Second, I'm going to demonstrate that war is inefficient. Precisely what I mean by that will become a little bit clearer in just a minute, and hopefully a lot clearer by the end of the lecture. Turn to the second slide. Let's start with a definition of bargaining. Ordinarily, that word has a pretty narrow meaning. It involves the explicit negotiation of the terms of an agreement or transaction, offers and counteroffers. It's basically synonymous with haggling. In this module, we'll use the term a bit more broadly, referring to any attempt to reach undisputed allocations, whether through negotiation, fait accompli, or even violence. Let's unpack that a little bit. By undisputed allocations, I mean that bargaining ends when we reach a point where no one is making any serious attempt to change the outcome. They may not all be happy with it, but they're no longer contesting it. And, so far as we're concerned, it doesn't much matter how they get to that point. I mean, it does, because we care a great deal, analytically and as human beings, about whether they resort to violence. But in terms of whether we'd call the process they're engaged in bargaining, no. We're not going to limit that term to formal negotiations, as might be carried out by heads of state or chief diplomats. We're including attempts to change the facts on the ground so that the other side will be forced to either take up arms or simply live with the new status quo, which, incidentally, is what the term fait accompli refers to, and doesn't involve any exchange of offers. This definition also leaves room for using force to take what you want directly from the other side, or compelling them to give in to your demands. For the sake of simplicity, we're not going to model any decisions states make during war, but it's worth acknowledging that bargaining doesn't end after the fighting begins. Wars are themselves part of the bargaining process. Because again, that term doesn't just mean negotiation, which we tend to think of as civil and polite, and can occur during wartime. For our purposes, bargaining includes all attempts to reach a final outcome and to alter the terms thereof. Next, let's clarify what we mean by war. Sometimes, people use that term in a very legalistic way. Journalists will write that some country has, quote, technically, end quote, been at war with its neighbor for 60 years, by which they mean that the two never signed a formal peace agreement. As far as I'm concerned, that's too clever by half. I see that as an attempt to make what would otherwise be a pretty boring story seem more newsworthy. That run counters to just about everyone's intuitive understanding of what it means for two countries to be at war. Similarly, the Korean War was, very obviously, a war. But President Truman chose to call it a police action. We know now that he did that because he feared that it would be less popular if he called it what it was. There was no other reason. The distinction between a war and a police action, by Truman's own private admission, is one without a difference. We're not going to play any such word games in this module. The definition we'll be working with has nothing to do with formal declarations and everything to do with death on a mass scale. More formally, we'll define a war as coordinated violence between two or more groups in an attempt to seize control of territory or coerce a change in behavior. Finally, let's talk about what it means to say that something is inefficient. Inefficient outcomes are those that entail greater costs than would have been incurred if the actors had done something else that would have gotten them to the same place or one that's just as good. When we say something is inefficient, we're necessarily making a comparison between two or more courses of action. I'm going to spend the rest of this lecture trying to convince you that war is inefficient because there are less costly ways of reaching equivalent outcomes. Okay, turn to the third slide where you'll find a model of crisis bargaining. We have two states, as usual. One that seeks to challenge the status quo, which we'll call C, and one that hopes to defend it, called D. The game begins with C choosing the size of a variable called X. That's what it means to say that they set its value within the range from 0 to 1, which is the way to read what I've written there on the slide. Here, X represents a proportion of what C wants, and it's precisely how much they'll end up with if the game ends peacefully. So if the crisis revolves around territory, then setting X equal to 0.5 would mean that C grabs half the territory in the hopes that D lets them get away with that rather than fighting a war to defend it. I'll give you some other examples soon. First, though, let me clarify exactly what X is and isn't. If you write in your notes that X is what C wants, as many students in the past have done, you're missing the point. C wants everything. What C is choosing strategically is how much to try to get. That might come in the form of a demand, a diplomatic proposal, or a fait accompli. Doesn't much matter. The point is, however X is communicated, that's what C will end the game with if D decides that it's not worth going to war over. But that's not what C wants. Except in very special circumstances, C wants a bigger change to the status quo than X represents. The only other choice in this game is made by D, who must decide whether to let C have X or fight them over it. If D accepts X, the game ends peacefully. If D rejects it, there'll be a war. In terms of payoffs, we're going to keep things simple and assume that the amount of utility each side gets from a peaceful outcome is determined simply by how much they get. That is, X is both an objective measure of how things got divided up and a subjective measure of how happy the challenger is with that outcome. The defender, as it says on the slide, gains utility equal to 1 minus X, because by assumption, they're satisfied with the status quo, but C has now shifted the outcome in the other direction by X amount. So if the challenger takes 75% of some disputed territory, D will be left with 25%, and their utility will be 0.25. If the two fight a war, their payoffs not only reflect the outcome C is expected to be able to impose on D, which is what W stands for, but also the fact that war is costly, hence the CC and CD terms. I want to be careful here because students have often gotten confused about these terms in the past. Do not put in your notes that W equals war. It doesn't. Because it is reached through war, I've used the first letter of that word to name this variable, but that doesn't mean you can just write W equals war in your notes and be done with it. It is the outcome of the war from C's perspective, measured as a proportion of C's most preferred outcome. Nor is it the probability of war. Knowing the size of W tells us precisely nothing about whether a war will occur or not. So if you are asked a question on the second test about the probability of war occurring under some set of conditions, you would not want to select W as the answer. Again, W tells us how close C came to getting everything that they want as a result of fighting. It is how far the outcome shifts in C's favor, which is why D gets 1 minus W. The cost terms can also be misinterpreted. They represent how much utility the players lose when they incur the costs of war. They are measured on the same scale as X and W, not in terms of lives lost or money spent. CC and CD tell us how much closer to their ideal outcomes C and D, respectively, would need to be in order to feel as though the war hadn't cost them anything. So if C is 0.2, then the challenger would prefer getting 55% of the territory peacefully to fighting a war in which they expect to gain control of 70% of the territory, because in that case, they're only going to be as happy as if they'd gotten 50%. Another way to think about this is, when you're fighting to repel an invasion of your homeland, you're willing to bear great costs, and so it might take a lot of fatalities to make you feel as though you'd lost the same amount of utility as you would have if you'd surrendered an additional 10% of the territory. But when you're fighting to put down an insurgency in some faraway country that's ultimately not even that important to your security or economic interests, it wouldn't take too many of your people dying before you'd start to think it would have been better to just let the insurgency unfold. So when you hear me talk in future lectures about what happens when CC or CD increases, don't interpret that as referring to what happens when wars become deadlier, because that's just one part of what determines how much utility states lose when they suffer the cost of war. It's an important part, I suspect, but still just one part. How important the issue is matters a lot too, and we'll take advantage of that later. Okay, so now we've talked about the basic structure of the model. C issues an ultimatum, or executes a fait accompli, and they get to decide exactly how bold that is. Then D decides whether to let C have X or not. If they do, the game ends peacefully, and C acquires X, leaving D with the remainder. If D does not give in, the two fight a war, and C acquires W, but suffers a loss of utility equal to CC, while D literally loses W in the sense that the actual outcome shifts by that much, while feeling as though they've also lost CD because war is inherently costly. Before we talk about whether D would be willing to give in, let's just talk a little bit more about what X might look like in different cases, about what it might mean for C to ask for 55% or 32% or whatever of something other than territory. On the fourth slide, you have two figures. The one on the left shows you a range of values of X when C's point of dissatisfaction with the status quo concerns D's support for some terrorist group. Thinking about proportions and percentages is less intuitive here, but the basic idea is still that X tells us how close the peaceful outcome is to C's most preferred one. When X equals 1, C is as happy as C can be. When X equals 0, D is as happy as D can be. When X takes on values greater than 0 but less than 1, there was a compromise, if not necessarily a cordial one. So in this case, D's most preferred outcome, and thus C's least preferred, might be for D to continue supporting the terrorist group, which I've called T. And C's most preferred outcome, which would be D's least preferred, would be for D to combat T and let C come into their country and establish permanent military bases so they could go after T themselves if they're not satisfied with how that's going. What about the intermediate outcomes? Well, we might say that when D stops supporting T but takes no action to get rid of them, that brings C 25% of the satisfaction they'd get from their most preferred outcome. So we'll call that X equals 0.25. Suppose D were to actually confront T, but not let C's forces into their country. Well, that would be pretty good from C's perspective, especially if D doesn't make C give them money to support their counterterror operations. So that might be 0.9. Or 0.45 if they do demand counterterrorism aid. The numbers I've chosen here are arbitrary, of course. Depending on how much financial assistance D asked for, it might make more sense to represent that outcome with X equals 0.8 instead of 0.45, and so on. But this should give you an idea of what it might mean for C to get X of what they want when their dissatisfaction with the status quo concerns something more abstract than disputed territory. Similarly, the figure on the right is there to help you think about what X might look like if the two sides are bargaining over multiple issues at the same time. Here, we've got a two-dimensional bargaining space, but we could apply this reasoning to three or four n dimensions if need be. Here, the two dimensions are the location and security of a border between the two states. I assume that C would like to have more territory, but would also like to know that there won't be any attacks on their people originating from D's side of the border, or refugees streaming in, or illegal immigrants coming over, or whatever. Here I've shown you indifference curves, lines that connect all the points over which the actors are indifferent, because they bring an equal amount of utility. For just two arbitrarily chosen values of X, 0.15 and 0.6. The figure is telling us that C might be 15% as satisfied with the outcome as they would have been if they'd gotten everything they wanted, when the border is 30% as secure as it could be, but they have to relinquish all claim to the disputed territory, or if they got 30% of the disputed territory, but got no assistance from D in securing the new border. Those two outcomes might be equivalent in terms of how satisfied C would be with them. Similarly, there's a whole range of outcomes that could bring C 60% of the satisfaction they'd get if they had all the disputed territory and D did everything they could to secure the border. For simplicity, I'll often talk about X as though it concerns just one issue, usually territory because that's the most straightforward. But you should understand that the model doesn't require us to make that strong an assumption. It allows for the obvious possibility that states care about other things, even many of them at the same time. Note that if there's a large number of issues at stake, the bargaining space is guaranteed to be awfully close to perfectly continuous, even if most of those issues in isolation are indivisible. I talk more in one of the optional lectures about what happens when the players find it hard to compromise for symbolic or electoral reasons, which I think is a possibility worth worrying about to some extent, But if you're asking yourself, what if there's no way to divide things up? I think you might be settling for an easy explanation for war. It is very rare for states to disagree about just one issue. And even if they did, the side that gives in can demand compensation along some other dimension, making the bargaining space effectively multidimensional, even if there is only one issue of contention. There's always money, if nothing else, and states do sometimes bribe one another with foreign aid. So it's hard for me to see how the literal impossibility of compromise could constitute a useful explanation for war. Many people have offered it, but I find it unsatisfying, and you should as well. Okay, let's get to the analysis of the model. Starting with what terms D will be willing to accept, which you can also think of as the range of demands they'd begrudgingly concede to, or fait accompli they'd let stand. What we want to know, in other words, is when will D prefer letting the crisis end peacefully, knowing that this will shift the outcome towards C by exactly X amount, rather than going to war. I've spared you the algebra that gets us there, which is actually pretty straightforward, and skipped straight to the result. D prefers peace to war, so long as C isn't taking too much from them, so long as X is not larger than X hat. That is, I've created a new term called X hat, which, as you can see from the slide, is defined as W plus CD, whose sole purpose for existing is to tell us how D will respond. More substantively, you can think of X hat as the largest demand that D will still give in to. Any value of X above that is going to make them fight, but they're willing to live with X hat itself, and would be delighted to see the challenger pick a value of X that's smaller than it, though, as we're about to discuss, they never would. You might be wondering why we assume that D chooses peace when X is precisely equal to X hat. If they're literally no better off giving in than going to war, we have little basis for confidently asserting that they won't fight. But think about it this way. If we're saying that the occurrence of war is a puzzle, and our explanation for war is that D sometimes figures, ah, screw it, six of one, half a dozen of the other, well, that's not terribly insightful. I'd like to be able to give you a better explanation for war than YOLO. And in fact, I can. And will in future lectures. Will the explanations I offer in the next couple of lectures account for all possibilities, perfectly explaining every war that's ever occurred? No, I suppose not. But it's not clear to me that any of history's wars were caused by total indifference. So we're just going to rule that out. You also might be wondering why we add the defender's cost of war here. The reason, simply enough, is that when the defender is more desperate to avoid war, because they find the costs unacceptable, they're willing to give in to larger demands. Remember, X hat is the largest demand to which D is still willing to concede. It should make sense to you, if you're translating from symbols back to English, that the largest demand that D will give in to is the one that requires them to give up no more than what they'll feel as though they've given up anyway if they choose to fight. Okay, so what about C's choice of X? Based on what we've already said and the implicit assumption of complete information, we'll relax that later, don't worry, C can anticipate that asking for more than the most that D is willing to give up, more than X hat will provoke a war, while asking for anything up to and including that amount will ensure that the crisis ends peacefully and on terms chosen by C. If it turns out that C is willing to stick within D's limits, even though they'd prefer a larger change to the status quo, they're obviously not going to pick a value of X that is less than X hat, because setting X exactly equal to X hat gives them more of what they want and still prevents war. In other words, if C knew that D would be willing to give up 50% of the territory without a fight, then C might or might not demand more than that. We haven't gotten far enough to say anything about that yet, but there's no way they'd demand less. That wouldn't make any sense. And if they do demand more than X hat, well, then it doesn't really matter how much more. Whether they demand 52% or 100%, if D is only willing to give up 50%, they've got a war on their hands. So, to figure out what C's optimal strategy is, what they're going to do in equilibrium, all we have to do is ask whether they prefer peace on the best possible terms, that's X hat, or war. Technically, the model gives C a whole range of options. They can set X to anything between 0 and 1. But ultimately, all that matters is whether C would be sufficiently happy with the largest concession they can actually get out of D, or whether they're going to press their case on the battlefield. Well, C is willing to choose X hat rather than provoking a war by going beyond that, if, and only if, the level of satisfaction they get from X hat is greater than the one they get from war. Here I do show you the algebra, because it's not that complicated, and I think it really does help you understand the argument more fully. Note that when C sets X equal to some value, and D accepts it, then that's exactly what C gets if the game ends peacefully. So what we want to know is whether X hat itself is greater than or equal to C's war payoff, which is W minus CC. And since X hat is, by definition, W plus CD, that means that C prefers X hat and peace whenever CC plus CD is greater than or equal to zero, which must be true. In other words, C prefers peace so long as war is costly, which it is. What does this tell us? That we can't claim to have explained war just because we've identified the issue in dispute. Knowing what is being fought over does not tell us why they're fighting over it. For example, it is often said that the cause of the U.S. Civil War was slavery. That's incomplete at best. Sure, anyone who isn't willfully denying some very well-established facts will acknowledge that what the war was fought over was slavery. The leaders of the Confederacy were quite clear about that, making no attempt to deny the utmost importance of slavery in their decision to secede. All this talk of states' rights as a deeper and more fundamental issue came later, when people realized that fighting a war in defense of such a brutal and inhumane practice would be utterly indefensible, but still couldn't bring themselves to let go of their sympathies for the Confederacy. But slavery was a contentious issue in U.S. politics from the very beginning. I've heard historians say that war was inevitable from the outset, which I think is mistaken, but still a better way to think about it than simply accepting the claim that a brutal war suddenly broke out in 1861 because of a disagreement that had divided the country since its founding. In other words, we have to ask ourselves how the country managed to go that long without fighting a war over slavery. Clearly, peaceful compromise was an option, one that had been chosen many times already. There were even attempts to resolve the secession crisis through further compromise. So you can't tell me that the explanation is that people gave up trying. They didn't. If we're to explain why hundreds of thousands of people died, we need to go a bit further. We need to explain why a more efficient outcome wasn't chosen. And I think I know why it wasn't. We'll return to this example in the next required lecture on commitment problems. The point is, this argument doesn't just go for the U.S. Civil War. In general, if we want to explain why war occurs, or why any particular war occurred, we absolutely must be able to answer the question, why didn't they compromise? And I don't mean that rhetorically, more lamentation than inquiry. It's a serious question, one that can be answered, as you'll see in the next couple of lectures. The point of this lecture isn't to say that it makes no sense for war to ever occur. It's to convince you that any explanation for war that doesn't answer that specific question, why didn't they compromise, is no explanation at all. As I mentioned in the very first lecture, war is actually a lot rarer than people realize, thankfully. Peace is the default state in the same sense that unbirthdays are. 99.7% of the time, it is not your birthday. And any given pair of states spends even more time not being at war with one another. Sure, most of them don't have any real disagreements either, but even if you take that into account, the picture doesn't change much. Again, there were more than 2,500 militarized interstate disputes, episodes where one state threatened to go to war against another, or perhaps even used force against them on a limited scale, but fewer than 100 of them became wars. So, even when we look just at cases where we know the states didn't get along, the vast majority of the time, they found ways to avoid mass bloodshed. It sounds kind of dorky to say that war is inefficient, and trite to explain that it's costly, but, well, that's a really big deal. And states seem to be well aware of it, even in awe of it. Perhaps we should be too.